Hello and welcome to the Generation for Change, a podcast series brought to you by the committee members of the G4C Southwest, which is part of the Constructing Excellence organisation. My name is Johnny Rees and I'm a committee member of the G4C and a senior architect at Bailey Partnership. I'll be your host for today's podcast as I chat to Tatiana Vella, who is a senior architect at Atkins Rios, and just having a chat today about her career, how she got there, and her role as a senior architect. So welcome, Tatiana.
Thank you very much, Johnny. Thanks for having me on this call, podcast.
Right. So as you may be aware, the committee members of the G4C Southwest have been interviewing a broad range of individuals who are involved in constructing and engineering industry. And that's just to demonstrate the variety of roles and opportunities that are available. So we're really looking forward to hearing about your role as a senior architect and kind of how you got there as well. So to start off, could you tell us a bit about your job, your role?
Yeah, sure. So my role as a senior architect is essentially of a project architect, which is essentially the managing architect in a project, doing both management of the project, but also the design elements of the project and bringing together the consultants and coordinating, putting forward design options, speaking to the client, and essentially taking the client on the journey, understanding their brief and their requirements, and developing a scheme with the whole team that reflects those requirements and, of course, meets it in budget. But in the main, the architect role or the project architect role is of bringing things together and of being a facilitator. Of course, you're one of many team members, and you often also work with project managers that do more the kind of admin side and management side, but you're sort of there as a lead designer as well. And that's the general role. The senior part only means that you have more experience and you've got more technical and management experience.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's a good distinction to make because it is, so the Royal Institute of British Architects kind of specifies those posts 5 years for your part three. In my experience, some practices kind of exercise this at their own kind of given discretion. So at the former practice I worked at, they kind of had their own different caps for it, but it is typically 5 years post finishing part three. Which kind of also goes on to our next point, just to explain to the listeners, because you've touched on it briefly there, as Atkins is this kind of global design, engineering, project management company. So how does your role as a senior architect kind of fit into the wider company? Are you working closely with them with different disciplines and kind of project managers, you said?
Yeah, absolutely. I've only just started working with Atkins Rios. It's been about a month now. But my previous experience has always been a smaller architecture-specific and architecture-focused practices. At Atkins Rios, there's sort of the difference in the sort of day-to-day is that you're actually working with consultants that are also part of Atkins Rios. But in your general role day to day, it's fairly similar. The project managers have more of a role as they would do in other projects because in my experience and, you know, working with you, Johnny, and Howard Tompkins and previous practices, project manager roles come in usually projects at a certain scale. So they won't always be there. And they're usually also clients coming from the client side. So they'd be client direct consultants that help essentially the client manage the project. At Atkins Rios, where in the project I'm working on at the moment, where most of the consultant team, including the project manager, is part of Atkins, they have a role that's very much part of the package that Atkins offers to a client. So in the day-to-day, you work with the project manager more often. So that means that some of the stuff that Johnny, we've been working on smaller projects or different kind of projects of different types of clients and so on. You end up doing a lot of project management work as a project architect, whereas what I'm seeing in this specific project is that there's a bit less project management for the architect to do, essentially, which is not a bad thing in general. But you're also one tiny step detached from the client than we would have usually been in a kind of traditional smaller architecture focused practice.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because our general experience is having that we're the main point of contact with the client a lot of times, and even with project managers and things like that, generally, we have to do a lot of client facing time things. And it's interesting because we've both found ourselves now in multi-disc practices coming from a practice that was completely architects. I'd be interested, some of the differences and pros and cons you see from it, because from my experience, it's very different now that like my M&E team are sitting just behind me, rather than it's an email out to another company.
In the, well, AtkinsRéalis is really a big company. It's the actually the architecture team, especially the team I'm in, which we're mainly doing SEND schools, so special needs education schools. We're quite a we're a tiny small team in the scale of the larger practice, and equally it's split into many different offices in the UK, but it's also part of AtkinsRéalis, which is actually a Canadian company. They merged in the last 2 years. So there's a lot of consultants that are also not just based in London, not just behind, they don't just sit behind me. So
Yeah, so similar
it's
dynamic
still,
then, really.
yeah, it's a
You're still
similar
emailing out,
dynamic. Yeah. So, and it's more a point of communication. We're working on Teams, of course, all the time, as most companies do. So we're like a Teams message away from the rest of our consultants rather than an email away. So there is a bit of that proximity does help. But also in terms of the client, I think for what I'm seeing as well, like the role of the architect really is very much the same in that you have to take the client on a journey, you have to build that trust with the client. And regardless of whether you're in a large multidisciplinary practice with a project manager, that doesn't change. You still have to build those relationships. You still need to understand your client and their needs and the user's needs. And the more that you can build that trust, the better your project you'll get out of it, because you'll understand them better. You'll be able to speak their language and show them what they need and what they want essentially, but from their point of view. So that doesn't really change. It's more the sort of communication in that the project manager is also on that journey that you need to take them on. And there's one more step of not just your design consultant team, but also the project manager has to be on board with your proposals and the direction you want to take it. So it's just that little step that, another member that you have to take on board.
I completely agree. I think regardless of whether you're just in a practice full of architects or more, just that kind of trust relationship with a client is still very much at the forefront of empowerment and taking them through the design journey, be it early stages or later design stages. And that role as architect is very much still a key part of our job outside of the drawing and the technical parts. So on that, can you explain to the listeners exactly kind of a typical day, let's say, or a typical week, which might be easier for your role? And how would you describe it? I'm sure it's very pasted.
Sure. I'm not sure it's changed that much really from working in different practices. Of course, it'll depend on the meetings you have. Design team meetings are usually once a week or once every 2 weeks. And in a week, that could take up most of your day. That's when you're meeting the rest of the consultant team, going through design options or proposals or things that arise, but you're coordinating and you're trying to understand. At the moment, I'm working on an existing building, so a lot of the conversations recently with the rest of the design team has been about how what this building really is, getting to know it, It's a bit like an investigation of you're trying to, a desk of an investigation until you get to site, what the building is, what you're, it would be the same if you were starting with a fresh site. So part of your week, you're like investigating your site. You're a bit got your like investigatory hat on. Part of your week, you're looking at brief requirements and understanding the client and user needs, but also any legislation and policy around it. And then another part of your week will be, thinking around design issues or trying to resolve some requirement needs through design, through spatial arrangement of new existing or new buildings that you're proposing. That's like the general, that's the main thing that you're doing. But along all these things, you're also doing your management administration side of leading a project. And this would be an example of where usually as an architect, you'd be setting up design team meetings and programming and scheduling meetings with the clients and trying to work out when is best to go to site, when it's best to meet your client on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, or rest of the team and organize other of these kind of larger management scope, like project management scope. You'd also be looking at your budgets, trying to understand how you're gonna, it depends where you are on the project, but you work a lot with the QS as well. So, I mean, I'm just like telling you all these things that architects do, but your week's gonna have a lot of that in it. In the main, in my experience, has often we'd be working in a practice, like in an office. But there's still some flexibility in architecture, which is really good. At the moment, I'm actually working 2 days in the office and the rest of the week at home, which is quite nice as well. But you are the points that where, sometimes in your week you have to go to site, so that would take a whole day, and your DTM could take a whole day. So the rest of your week, you're catching up with solving the design issues and the requirements and trying to. At the moment, I'm just stuck in an existing building that I haven't actually visited, and I'm going to go on Monday. So I'm really in that sort of exploratory phase. Yeah, that doesn't give you an idea of what's in a week.
Oh yeah, no,
Just
it's, I appreciate there's a lot to pack in because yeah, it
different
varies quite a lot. And I think
Yeah, it varies.
as we've already kind of mentioned slightly, particularly with this stage in our careers being senior architects, you end up being more client facing, running projects, which means that you have to do the admin side to it as well. You have to be running project team meetings, kind of running a team as well. Be interested to just for listeners that may be earlier on that are looking to get into architecture or are earlier on in their career. In my experience, the role I've had for the last, say, 5 or so years is very different to, as you'd imagine, to my starting role, which in my first practice, I was producing just drawings, like for planning applications of things on AutoCAD and Revit, producing Photoshop visuals. And then that eventually kind of led to more technical design. And I suppose as I progressed through my master's and after part three and things, and got that was when I started going into more of like a project senior architect, project architect role, running jobs. And I was gradually coming off maybe producing the drawing and materials for presentations and things as much. And you'd have people earlier on in their career that are really crucial in producing that information.
That's exactly it. At this stage, when we're thinking about the project program, we have to slot in and understand what deliverables we need to achieve and submit at the end of each stage, and that's following the REBA plan. So once you're, as you progress in your career, you're looking at these programs and these projects in a much larger scale, like you're sort of stepping back, and a lot of the work you do is also, like you said, you're planning things at longer time periods, and you're looking at the project more, less in sort of the, you know, building that Revit model and getting that right and producing those drawings, but you're looking at things more strategically. So you're looking at the program more strategically, you're looking at the, you know, actual drawings and documentation that you need to produce in a more strategic way, and sort of what is each one of these gonna, what information are you putting in each of these, and how is that information meeting your list of deliverables? And then what does that document look like? You might be, you know, scheduling out or doing a storyboard of that document, but you're never working on your own. You're always working, well, sometimes you are when there aren't enough resources, but you're, you know, the idea is that you're working with a team, and your team is made up of architectural assistants, architects, and of course then the wider consultant teams. And each of those will have their skills and capacities to deliver, like to actually produce and do part of those deliverables. And you're there trying to, you know, managing, okay, when do we do this document that has to be submitted then? What's it going to have? What's the story that we're telling throughout the whole project? But it's a story that we're telling to the client and to everyone on board to get them to, you know, believe in the project, want to do the project, build momentum around the project.
No, that's absolutely right. And the key bit as well is that regardless of where you are as an architect, you're very much in a team. It's a team exercise, which is you can say very much so about construction and engineering industry on a wide front as well, that you are part of a team to deliver these things. They don't happen in isolation. You're always working with different disciplines, but also many colleagues as well, be them architects or M&E or structural project managers. You're very much always in the same environment. So what would you say has been your biggest career highlight to date?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I probably should have thought about that
I was really intrigued. Yeah.
one. Working with you, Johnny.
Absolutely. Yeah, there we go. We can go to the next question. There we go. Yeah.
I think maybe it's more, it's maybe less of a highlight as a particular event, but I think it's more been about the breadth of experience in different sectors that I've worked on. And you know, that only happens as the more experience that you gain, because then you have the, you know, time and capacity to go into different sectors. So I mean, I think for me it's been the different scales at which and the diversity of projects that I've worked on. So having started, I mean, my first job was with Skeet and Kathleen de la Peña in a long time ago now. But you know, working in a very particular area in London, mostly around Soho and Mayfair, and this was all very high-end members clubs and residences and shops, like commercial but very bespoke and detailed. And I even worked on a boat, like a boathouse. So there was like really a
Awesome.
variety of the whole world that I went into that I had absolutely no idea about. Rushing from like meetings in Mayfair to a boat and to things like this. So it was more this sort of like interest in getting to know different parts of, like throughout my experience, different parts of London, different and the world, but different sectors as well. And like starting off from there, moving then to generally high-end residential, where I was doing a lot of joinery and bespoke interior design. Then moving on to larger residential, whether it was like high-rise or also energy strong refurbishments. So this is a particular type of refurbishing existing homes. It was a method that was developed in the Netherlands, and it's a performance-based approach. So the idea was that we were putting on these jumpers on existing council homes in Nottingham. And within, like as part and as the one of the key parts of the project was not just improving the thermal mass of the building itself, the thermal fabric, but also integrating a energy system that would drastically reduce the energy performance, like the energy consumed by these buildings, with the main aim that the bills would go down and less energy was necessary. So it was starting off from a very servicing mechanical point of view. And that was a really great experience. And it's still a project that's going on. It's called Nottingham City Homes 2050. So by 2050, a whole bunch of these homes will have been refurbished. So that was completely a different direction that I went after having done a lot of residential of different scales. And then in my next practice at John McCaslin, I was working at residential and industrial co-location projects, and we managed to get the first planning application for a co-location of residential and industrial in one building, vertically stacked. So that was like another big achievement, but also that, you know, fed a lot to what the London plan was developing into intensifying industrial spaces and releasing sites for housing needs. And actually, and this is how I ended up at Howard Tompkins and working at Tony Rees, because then we went on to building an intensified multi-story industrial scheme with how many actual units were there? Like 25?
42.
42. Yeah.
We had the smaller ones at the top. Yeah, yeah, the larger.
Exactly. So, So, you know, going from like a boathouse to a huge industrial multi-story building, that was a journey in itself that obviously took years to get from one place to the other. But through that, it's like the highlight has been in seeing how all the different sectors work. Both from the architectural side and the engineering side, but very much from the client, the policy side in London, and kind of gaining this like larger understanding of how the built environment works, how it's procured, how it's designed, how it's built, and all the things that are, you know, lead to, you know, kind of creating, or how do you say, giving it the path that it's on, the reasons why it is where it is and where it might be going. But that's sort of like larger kind of thinking about, again, the built environment from an even larger point of view, from a city or state point of view. So I think it's been that the fact that you're able to, through these experiences, to hone in on designing you know, a junction between a cabinet door and the cabinet side, to really, you know, getting a bigger understanding of how the built environment works.
Yeah, I completely agree, because I look back on my earlier, like, just little extensions and planning up to things like that with just the fondness as I would have any of my later career works as well, that you'll kind of help on this journey through your career, that you learn so much at each one. And yeah, it takes you on this path through, and there's always just interest in the variety of projects you get to work on as an architect.
Yeah.
But from your career highlight, which is really interesting career as well, would you say you have a favorite feeling about your current role?
I think actually for my current role, it's more to do with how I'm able to work. I am in a new sector yet again. So I hadn't done a schools, let alone special needs school. So this has definitely been interesting in the point of view that I quite like that diversity. But I'm actually, now I'm working as a self-employed, a contractor. So, well, not necessarily self-employed, but I'm working on a contract basis. And that's the first time I've been doing that, of course. Until now, I've been working as a full-time employee. And this has allowed me to keep some flexibility in how I work, so that I'm able to work less than 5 days a week. And it's also a short contract it's a six-month contract that has the ability to be extended, but also has the ability for me to do something else in 6 months if that's what I want to do. Of course, to be in this position has definitely been a choice, and that in itself, it has been a privilege on my part being able to do that. Most of the time we see full-time employee roles be broken back down to contract roles in ways that doesn't protect the worker or the contractor in this case, and where they don't have much of a choice. In my situation, I've been lucky to be able to look for that by choice. It's very little out there in architecture, working in that sort of way. But it has allowed me to go into actually designing joinery and furniture and jewelry as well, which was something that I was quite interested in. Not necessarily, so when I left Howard Thom, because I wasn't aware that that's what I wanted to do, but I wanted to take some time off because, as you know, and we know, it's quite a demanding career. And it was a point after, how many years have I been practicing? Probably too many, like 15 years approximately, right? Like not since qualification, it's been 10 years. But something that I wanted to do was do more hands-on things. And I mean, a lot of architects are interested in building things themselves, coming, you know, putting things together, because that might have been where we started off from, like the liking and to, you know, wanting to understand how things come together physically. And then we end up drawing them, but we don't often make things ourselves. And that detachment is sometimes useful, but also sometimes not so useful. If we, you know, we need to know, we're drawing things, we need to know how that works in three dimensions. And we have that ability to see that in our mind, and we have tools that help us see that, you know, whether it's Revit or SketchUp or other model making, physical making tools. But it was just something that I was more interested in at this point, where, you know, staring at a screen for 5 days a week, it can be quite hard on you. And it was, I felt like at this point of my career, if I wanted to try something different, it would be now. So that's where I took a little bit of time off and started making joinery and jewelry. So that, knowing that I had that on the side, I wanted to go back to something that was not a full-time job.
Absolutely. I think it's very typical of, well, architects, and I'm sure other professionals in the construction and engineering industry, to have a passion for making and, you know, artistic endeavors outside of work. So Zaha did famously painted a lot through her career, like so many architects, and just really enjoy making. And for instance, my university course ethos was thinking through making. So lots of model making. And as many of us have found it, and as from architects to everyone, we'll find that with passions like jewelry making really enforce your work, and it benefits from it. See things in a slightly different way, that eye for detail, that kind of thinking of the process of making itself just really informs your work.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, I mean, in the end, what architects design spaces for activities to take place into. So it only, like, we do find, you know, whether it's inspiration or knowledge in our making things ourselves. And having studied architecture, there are many different paths you can take. And a lot of my friends from uni are not architects anymore. Many of them have gone further into making things or into engineering or completely other things that are, you know, that whether it's actually going into more management roles like project management, design management. Many people become surveyors as well, where they, you know, you need a really good understanding of buildings. And there are definitely other avenues, and both, you know, creative as well as management or administrative or strategic. So architecture definitely gives you the education, at least, but hard for me to say what education is like at the moment, but I mean, apprenticeship schemes are quite positive in the sense that you get real experience of what it's like to work in architecture, but you also get exposed to other of these roles, and you know, like we were just saying before, like Adkins Rails has a lot of in-house consultants of different types, and through those experiences and importantly, through networking and those experiences, you can be exposed to other options and other paths. And it's totally fine to find another path or to need or want another path. Now's the time we, like, at least for me, I was like, okay, if I'm going to try something different, I better do it now. And
yeah, I understand. So
I'm that's still actually on a journey. I don't know where
I'm going. Well, I think, we will all be, aren't we?
We've kind of already mentioned it. Like, I mean, the aim of these podcasts is to encourage young people to start a career in the construction and engineering industry. We mentioned a moment ago about your kind of highlights in your career and your favorite parts there. I mean, the aim of these podcasts is to encourage young people to start a career in the construction and engineering industry. We mentioned a moment ago about your kind of highlights in your career and your favorite parts there. So, but when did you decide it was kind of a career choice for you?
Do you mean to be an architect?
To be an architect. Was this, because it's quite different for everyone. Some people land in it, some people very clear from early age.
Yeah. I was actually going to study chemical engineering. Because I liked the sciences, I liked chemistry. I was really good at maths. But I always, I did the International Baccalaureate, and it's similar in that you have some high level subjects, some standard level subjects, a bit like the A levels. And I didn't do art only because I didn't need that many subjects. I was taking too many subjects. But it was always something that I definitely was interested since I was very little. And had it been my way, I would have probably chosen to be an artist first and then been a chemical engineering. But then I went on a family holiday to, where did I go? I can't even remember. I went to the south of Spain, where is this beautiful mosque that I should remember the name of. But it's like an Islamic mosque that has been turned into a Christian cathedral. I'm gonna have to find the name because it's really embarrassing that I don't know. And through that experience, I was like, oh, you know what, this building is amazing, this is crazy, like there's so much in here that I find so fascinating. And that was at the same time that we were having these, you know, we were like signing up to our university applications, and there were people around, like careers advisors, and what they actually told me was that maybe I should be an engineer for like nuclear or oil industry, oil sector, because they were trying to put together this, like, you know, it came up that I was quite good at three-dimensional space and all these things, right? And they were like, you should do that, otherwise, like, maybe like go into the perfume industry. And I was like, I have no idea where this came from. But that kind of introduced me to the, you know, the architecture as a sector, as a potential thing. And I didn't know anything about it. All I knew was that I liked art and I liked maths, and that was a good middle ground. So I didn't have nobody, I didn't know any architects. Nobody told me if that was a good idea or not. Maybe having known what I know, maybe I would have done something different or maybe tried different things. But, you know, it's a very long career. It's not well remunerated. So when you compare the long education, the cost of your education, how long it takes to qualify, and then you get into these moments where you're burning out, and you know, it's notoriously, it's not necessarily known as a career that's good for your mental health. And this is, you know, there's a lot that has to be done in the sector about this. But now when I'm thinking about what I'll, you know, do I go into a different sector? Do I try different things? I keep coming back to the design is ultimately what I'm most interested in. And 3D spatial design, and being able to build it as well. So it only makes sense that I am an architect, you know, despite this whole path. But yeah, I mean, that's how I got into it, to answer your question. And I think those things still ring true. I think I would have ended up here anyway, because I do think
just because of your interests.
Exactly.
Yes, I mean, so do you, it's interesting, especially considering what we've discussed. That so, where does your role as a senior architect, where does that lead you? Because you've already touched as well that you have like interests that you pursue outside of it. Is there a clear path that your role as senior architect at Kinsrealis takes you?
I'm not really sure. I think with these other interests, I think I need to see how viable they are. I did sort of decide a little while ago that I didn't really see myself continuing in architecture, retiring as an architect. And it's a lot of it is more to do with it, like things that I was mentioning before. I don't necessarily see it as a career that you will, it's not necessarily a safe career and that you're necessarily retire in a good position. That's not to say that other careers are foolproof. And, you know, we are sort of in a situation where there is a cost of living crisis, where things are quite unsettled and everyone's salaries are not keeping up with inflation, let alone raising. So where do we want to be when you retire? That's a question that, we probably not going to be where I hoped I would be when I retire. But also, architecture is, there's so many small practices, and there's very few large ones. But even within the role of what you do, like where do you go from being senior architect up the ladder, as you would imagine traditionally to think about a career? You go up the ladder, you get to a position where you're quite senior and it pays well and you're sorted for retirement and then, well, everything's good. Life doesn't happen like that anymore, you know. We've seen that our parents, from our generation at least, had a kind of setup that worked for them, but it doesn't seem to be happening anymore. So I'm not that interested, however, in being an associate or a director. So,
which are the kind of typical...
Yeah, which is your typical next steps route. Going up. Yeah. And part of it is because the more you become more senior and you go up the ladder, you're maybe doing less of design. You're being more a business person and managing a business, and your interest in terms of what you need to or what your job role is becomes different to what it is as a designer. You're now more managing a company, a business. You have to make sure that the books and the finances are in order. It's actually a different job, and it's often a job that we're not skilled up to do, because, well, we might get some management course and some leadership courses, but it's not implemented neither from our university education nor through your career. And you know, if you want to do that and you seek out those skills, and that's great, and do those courses and go that path, it's not something that personally I'm interested in. And what I see and what the experience I've had is that you really need to become a different person, and it's not necessarily a person that I want to see myself turn into. You know, it's the you stop being a worker per se, you're not with your peers anymore, and you become a boss. Some people want to do that, great. That's not necessarily and because I've seen it quite cutthroat out there, especially in architecture, that's not something that I necessarily want to do. So, and this is also why I've seen that maybe I need to find a different path. I do have all these other interests, and now was the right time to do that. So it was about a bit of understanding from myself, what else can I try that I also that is also viable. And so this moment in time for me is having a job that is flexible enough that allows me to do that. So we'll see. And also, of course, it's a new type of company that I've not worked into such a large company before. And we were talking about, you know, avenues and different roles that multidisciplinary companies allows you to, you know, exposes you to. So, and I'm going to explore it further. I've only been here 4 weeks, so I've got a time to go and see where that takes me.
Yeah, reflecting on your career and your experience in practice has allowed you to kind of just better place where you want to be and kind of navigate it in a way that works better for you, which I think is the right way to go about it. So I think the next question regarding further education. Some practices do it differently. My experience is that there would be practices willing to help. You can do your master's degree for architecture part-time, which takes 3 years rather than two, but the practice can support the fees for your master's in doing that. When it gets to part three, some practices pay for it, some pay towards it, and you pay them back with salary, or some you just have to pay yourself, which is generally how it works with architecture and how we kind of get to our full qualification. Mm-hmm. Is there anything at Atkins Realis they do to kind of support further education? For instance, if you wanted to look into Passive House certification or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, what I have noticed at Atkins is the amount of apprenticeships and, you know, apprentices that work there is a lot larger than I'd seen anywhere else. Most of the architectural assistants in our team are going through an apprenticeship path. Oh, so it looks like they're quite supportive of that. And you know, I think it's like 2 days a week or 1 day a week is reserved for your university studies. And generally, at least in the architecture team, the other architects and senior people that have been there are really supportive about it. And in terms of further education, there are, this is something actually I need to look into still. But there are, especially if you're a full-time employee, there are a bunch of benefits that that are beyond what we've seen in traditional practice and smaller practices. And this is, I think, purely to the fact that it's such a large international company. So it does, you know, it has its pros and its cons. I mean, it's a large corporate office, which doesn't necessarily have the vibe and the camaraderie that we see in smaller practices. But then it has a lot more avenues and support that that smaller practices don't have, and like more support for apprenticeship and further education and courses and things like that. And also the time to allow you to do these things. So, in that sense, definitely, you know, if I was a younger architect, I would definitely look at these options and I'd be more strategic in what I was doing it. Maybe in that sense, you know, if I were to go backwards in time a little bit, I would try to be more strategic and try to explore more what the avenues are. And I do see younger architects doing that. That's really great. I think they're a bit more switched on and these things that we were, maybe Johnny, and you know, I hear them talking more about you know, making sure that the time they're not doing too much overtime or they're, and you know, which you see a lot. And I would say as well is join a union. Unite has a section of architectural workers sector. And that's for anyone in the built environment, essentially. If you're like working with architecture or within architecture, that's something that's open to you. And it's something that I was quite involved over COVID, and the need for a union was so paramount and so obvious. It seemed insane that there wasn't one yet, but it's something that's growing, and that, you know, that's where probably I got most of my labor education from, understanding your rights, even things like this, which usually you get from university, but the days that you should have off, what should be paid by your company and what shouldn't. You're entitled to certain amount of leave, you know, as part of the Royal Institute of British Architects, putting that down as a requirement for an RABA and ARB accredited practice. So inform yourself, educate yourself, you know, get everything you need to make sure you're making decisions that that make sense to you. But also don't be afraid of, you know, making decisions without knowing if they're the right ones. You just have to keep, sometimes you just have to keep testing it and talk to people, learn from other people.
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned, further education, completely different 10 to 15 years ago, massive increase in university fees. I just managed to miss that. But I do think that the generations of architects and in general in the construction industry coming up are a lot more tuned in to apprenticeships, internship placements, because yes, because the fees are so much now as well. And I do think, particularly at least in my experience through my education and through my career, everyone was always very helpful. Other architects were very helpful for me becoming an architect, kind of helping with weird people in the practice that were helping review my part three dissertations, and you know, you'd have people help guide you through the system a bit. But we mentioned it, well, absolutely, with your talk about union. What would you say some of the key issues you think that need to be addressed in the next few years or in decades in the industry?
Well, it's too many probably, but to start, I mean, there is both a cultural but also really basic ones like fees, like the fact that the fee scale got removed years ago because it was advised that it was creating a monopoly. Basically, the fees that architects can charge to clients, there used to be a scale and that got wiped away. It's not to say that a scale would solve the problem, but there is definitely an undercutting of practices amongst themselves to win projects. And by doing so, they reduce the fees. And the impact of that is essentially in architects, architectural assistants, architectural workers working overtime, because that overtime isn't paid. So you're essentially giving, you know, hours of your personal life away when you're not going to see that in return. You're not going to, your salary isn't going to go up. You're very, you know, there's so many competitions and bids out there that require multiple number of practices to do a lot of design work essentially for free. And that type of system only degrades both the value that architects bring, but also the salaries and the hours that are put in towards it. And the culture of that we got a lot in our education, at least, was, you know, the all-nighters, the working late, the getting the best drawing outs, again, like all these extra things that are not necessarily actually necessary. At what point do you stop? And as you progress in your career, and one of the things that was always really important to me was not to push that culture along and not to push that onto the architectural assistants and the rest of the team I was working with. So, you know, and did that take a hit on my career? Maybe, who's to say? But if I had to do the opposite and make my teams work overtime, then that's not the kind of thing I wanted to do. That's not the path I wanted to take. But there are fundamental things that need to be addressed in the industry. That is definitely the main thing. But it's also the understanding of architectural workers that they are workers. And very often the way that we've been taught is that one day we'll be the star architect and open our practice and all these things. But, you know, and be the director and everything. But there's only a few, you know, every company has a director, but there's one director or two directors or not a few number of directors, and the rest of us are workers. And we can't keep thinking that we're going to become that director and all our problems will be solved. Because not only are, okay, that one person selfishly got that job and then nobody else did, but that's the way businesses run, right? So we can't expect that to change. But what it's more is that we need to understand our role in wider society as a worker and understand the value of our work and the value of our time and understand how, you know, how value is created and how wages are defined. And that sort of understanding will give us a much better approach to how we work. And then between companies, of course, everybody wants that job because then they won't have projects and then they won't have staff and so on and so on. But maybe there are too many architects, right? It's like we produce so many architects every year in this country and in many other countries, but it's not a profession that's as necessary as, let's say, medics, right? Or lawyers. The work that we do is not protected. The role that we call ourselves as architects is protected.
Protected title.
It's a protected title, but not a protected actual work.
Yeah.
So there is definitely something not aligned there. And, you know, these are definitely things we can talk about. But I think fundamentally, it's like understanding that we are workers and we are doing wage labor and how that fits in the wider scope of how our economy runs, how businesses and our industries run. And that will give you a sort of better approach to how you do your own work and the work that you want to do.
Absolutely. And it's definitely things that need to be addressed in the next few years. It's come up throughout my education. I think it's really important for anyone looking to get into the career to consider early on to make sure, because as I was told coming up through it, you have to kind of be that change basically to make sure it happens.
Yeah, so, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Would you say what do you think in regarding the construction engineering industry, what do you think is doing well in terms, is it addressing any of these issues that you've highlighted or anything wider to do with addressing climate change, for instance, or how we design ourselves sustainably?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely a keen interest in sustainability, and rightly so. There is definitely a push in engineering, but often when we see it come down to it, you know, things are value engineered out because of cost or because of complexity of building. And so I think I don't want to be the negative one here, but I think we need to get to a point where you know, we're having more strategic ways of thinking and how we build sustainably, and whether it's not demolishing, whether it's not building, but also seeing that. And as architects, we're very good at this, as finding solutions to problems that don't necessarily need to be building something. You know, it's more about trying to understand what is really necessary to make whatever activity that is required possible without overly building just because we're architects and therefore we need to build. But we have the capacity to find more strategic and creative solutions to issues that could be brought to us. And in the same, and like if we think about sustainability in that way, we could find alternative solutions that don't rely necessarily on high tech, but actually rely on low tech. And I think something like, you know, like improving the fabric of a building and the way it's used, acutely in line with the climate and the functions that are going to happen in there, is as important than that the engineering of a complicated method of high tech sustainability. So it'd be nice to see, and there is many examples of where that's being done. So I mean, there are definitely things that are happening that are quite positive, but equally still, we have to be quite aware of what the implications of any solution is, whether it's implication locally or also further away. Of course, right now there is a lot of new minerals that we need for our batteries and our solar panels and things like that. And that's starting to be talked about a lot, so that's good. But yeah, we need to follow on those conversations and push and, you know, find new solutions working with our engineers. We have to be working in teams. I mean, that's probably the most important takeaway, is like the amount of work that is done in a team, and being able to work well together.
Perfect takeaway to start wrapping things up with. So thank you very much for your time today, Tatiana Vela. We have one final question, which is a really tricky one, actually. So if you have to describe the construction and engineering industry in 3 words, what would they be?
That's too hard, Johnny. That's another one I should have had prepared. But I think it's at a turning point, just to leave it there, very vague.
It's quite profound, yeah.
Yeah. To find the turning points, it depends on the sectors as well. It depends on bigger things at play, where countries are putting funding into. Right now, it's nuclear. And you hear that a lot in Atkins Relis, because there are engineers that work specifically in that sector. But I would consider the built environment engineering much broader than that. So it's more, I'm putting at a turning point because it's more of an approach, and an approach to how we build and we design. And things are, you see things changing the way people work, the client's needs. There's always a lack of funding, so it's always need to find new solutions, innovative solutions. And I think it's feeling like there's going to be bigger conversations coming up. So that's why I'm going to leave that there. And if you're a young young professional, get yourself acquainted with the broader things at play when you're working in a sector. You can easily bring down to focusing just on your day to day, and it's very easy to happen. It's very easy to feel individual or isolated, but we're much of something much larger, and we have to understand what our role is in that. And it doesn't have to be a huge role, but know how your role feeds things that are changing. That's super vague, and I hope I haven't confused anyone. But think of things with a bigger picture in mind.
Brilliant. That's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you very much for your time, Tatiana.
You're welcome, Johnny. It's great to speak to you again.
Good to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.